Hello and welcome. This is Open Air, KALW's radio magazine for the Bay Area performing arts scene. I'm Renee Kemp, your guest host today, and we have three wonderful segments. It's so nice to be able to step away from the news of the day and talk about the Bay Area's remarkable performing arts scene. And we're going to start by talking with two actresses from the ACT Geary Theater performance of 1,000 Splendid Suns. It's running through July 29th at the Geary Theater. And it's based on the international best-selling novel by Bay Area author Khalid Hosseini. Of course, for those of us who read the book, we recall that this is truly an epic story of three generations of Afghan women who find themselves bound together by tradition and culture, marriage and family, and by a secret past. And of course, the backdrop is that of a war-torn nation and the history of what happened in modern-day Kabul. So we will be talking today with the two principal actresses in that production. Also, from the Merula Opera Program today, we'll meet with Tara Faircloth. She directs Mozart's opera Il Re Pastore. It's part of Merula's 2018 Summer Festival. It will be running through August 18th, and we'll talk about not only this particular performance, but the long-standing history of the Merula Opera Program. And we'll also be checking in with the goings-on at music at Menlo's 16th Festival. This year's festival takes a musical and historical journey through 7 cultural capitals of Western music through August the 4th. The festival will present concerts and master classes and symposia, and we will be looking at that program and the performances that are coming up. But first, let's start with 1,000 Splendid Suns. Again, for those of us who read the book, it's interesting to imagine what this looks like, how it translates into a stage production. Of course, the premiere was last February 2017, and so some of us have had a chance to see it. I'm looking forward to being able to see it, and I'm really looking forward to talking with the actresses who literally breathe life into these characters and make them three-dimensional. Let's start with Denmo Ibrahim, who plays Miriam. She is reprising the role of Miriam in 1,000 Splendid Suns after originating the roles of Fariba and Nana in the world premiere at ACT and also at Theatre Calgary. Her recent credits include Catherine in Splendor at the Aurora Theatre Company, and she received the San Francisco Bay Area Theatre Critics Circle Award and nomination for Best Actress in a Principal Role for Noor in Our Enemies, Lively Scenes of Love and Combat. Her roles are many and acclaimed. Her most critically acclaimed solo show, Baba, developed at the New York Theater Workshop, won her a San Francisco Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Award for Best Original Script. She has a Master of Fine Arts from Naropa University and a Bachelor in Fine Arts in acting from Boston University, and a founding artistic director, can't wait to talk a little bit about this, at Mugwumpin, and resident artist of Golden Thread Productions. Denmo, I had to make sure that we got all of your credits in there. I even left a few out, but the bottom line is that you are a remarkable performer, and I'm so looking forward to talking to you about the role that you'll be playing in 1,000 Splendid Suns. So welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Renee.
And you're joined by Nadine Malouf, who plays Layla in 1,000 Splendid Suns. She originated the role of Layla at ACT last year. Most recently, she was seen off-Broadway in a new play, Queens, at the Lincoln Center Theater. And Malouf also performed in the one-woman site-specific New York premiere of Oh My Sweet Land with the Play Company. She played the title role in the world premiere of Salome with the Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, D.C., winner of 7 Helen Hayes Awards in 2016. And her other recent off-Broadway work includes Today Is My Birthday and Ultimate Beauty Bible. The School for Scandal is also in her repertoire. And Who, The Who and The What, along with Exile, and she has film and television credits as well, including The Looming Tower, Resolutions, and May in the Summer. She trained at Syracuse and the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London. Nadine Malouf, or should I say Layla, thank you so much for being here today and talking about A Thousand Splendid Suns and your performance in that work.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's talk about the book and how it somehow, because it was so sweeping in its scope, how do you confine something that spans many decades and war? I mean, literally, it traces the history of Afghanistan from the time of the Soviet takeover, the war, all the way up to Reconstruction. So let's start with you, Nadine. How do you confine all of that into a stage performance?
I think you have to begin with an incredibly talented creative team. Our writer, Ursula Rani Sarma, and our director, Kerry Perloff, really were incredible in dissecting the book, which is so loved by so many. And Khaled wrote an incredible story, as you say, over decades of time. And they were really wonderful in condensing it and really thinking how to put this on stage that would translate, that wasn't just putting the book on stage as it was, but really kind of morphing it. And the play is quite different. I mean, for those who read the book and loved the book, it's not exactly like the book, and we don't have everything, you know, in the play that exists in the book. But for example, the play begins really in the middle of the book, where the two women actually meet. And so time is really elastic in this production. It goes back and forth, and there's a lot of movement. And I think that's part of the magic of the piece, is the watching the audience kind of travel with us through this story.
And you play Layla. Tell us about Layla and her character.
You meet Layla when she is a very, very young girl, and you see her first with her parents getting ready to leave Kabul. And you follow her through many, many years and a lot of trials and love and heartbreak and friendship. And she, in the book, her nickname is Revolutionary Girl. So she's a fighter, and you see her strength really tested in this 2.5 hour play. And it's her friendship with Mariam that that gets her through it, and her children. But also this incredible friendship that she is fortunate to find.
And then, Mo Ibrahim, you play Miriam. And, I mean, what a character that had to be. She was born out of wedlock. I mean, tell us, bring us up to speed on just who she is.
Miriam is one of those women that comes into the world with a really hard situation. You know, she's born out of wedlock with a mother that, through all her efforts to protect her, has really painted a world in which Mariam is really set up to fear everyone that may come through it. And the men in her life, her father, who eventually she discovers betrays her, and then ultimately her husband, she never really finds any kind of intimacy or closeness. And what's so beautiful is in the book, you really, and in the play, you really have an opportunity to see the soul of Mariam before the adults and the world color her, that she is in essence a dreamer and a visionary for herself, that she dreams of school, that she dreams of a life that she doesn't know what it is, but the one she has, she knows there's more that she could have. And so when we meet Mariam, we see a woman that has been hardened by the world, battered and cold. And, you know, through in many ways a miracle of circumstances. Lailaw comes into her life and, you know, first is sort of the other woman and creates an incredible rage. But through the children, this opening of love opens and friendship is discovered, and we discover Mariam, you know, in this incredible, I think she becomes the woman that she knew she could be, you know.
Well, Mariam, your character miscarries many times.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned that it's the connection of the children that bring these two women together. So given that your character is not able to bear children, and how do you explain that the children become the conduit to these women and their relationship? Do you have a feel for that?
I mean, you know, in the story, Mariam had, you know, when school wasn't a possibility, motherhood was. And for the first time in her life, that was her purpose, the hope of being able to finally raise children, have children. And when that dream was crushed, not once, not twice, but 6 or 7 times, and that reality of being barren was going to be the reality, once the child came into the life, it was like, you know, I think it feels like Mariam was always a natural mother. And for once in her life, she was really good at something. And one of them was taking care and raising her child. Lailaw has her first child when she is a child. She's at 16, 15. So because of the circumstance, it kind of creates a situation where we need each other, even though we don't want each other or need each other. So I imagine that it really is the children that creates, or the child, Aziza, that really creates the opportunity for us to begin to lean in.
You're hearing the words of Denmo Ibrahim, who plays in 1,000 Splendid Sons, the ACT performance at the Geary Theater. And Nadine Malouf plays Layla. And I'm wondering, because you say that you met in the play when it begins, it's when you two women meet. So how difficult is it for those who haven't read the book, how difficult is it for you to create fully formed characters without the benefit of maybe the theater audience having the benefit of having their backstories? How do you breathe life into them without people really knowing where they came from and the abuse that they've suffered? Nadine, do you have a feel for how you are able to do that?
It's certainly difficult. I mean, we are able to flash back to Mariam's childhood, and we see her backstory a little bit more than Lailaw's. And, you know, you only have a limited amount of time, and so there are these characters who maybe have one scene, who there are chapters in the book. So I spent a lot of time reading the book and really collecting every detail, and it's a tremendous skill that our entire company of talented actors do, is bring that richness in a few minutes of time on stage. And I think it does translate to the audience. It may not always be a literal translation, but it is the feeling that you get, that you only see Lailaw's parents, who are educated and loving, and but also, you know, have their own trials and tribulations. You see them for one scene in the play, but in that scene, so much is communicated about where Lailaw came from. So it's a difficult task, but I think this show does it impeccably well.
I think it's a tribute, too, to the playwright herself, Ursula Rani Sarma.
Absolutely.
That she's able to figure out a way to get you engaged in these two women's lives without the benefit of chapters and chapters that have already unfolded. And it's a 2-week engagement through July 29th, part of a West Coast tour that includes San Diego's Old Globe Theater and the Seattle Repertory Theater. So talk about your roles as, and the secret as it unfolds. I mean, we're not, I don't know, do we reveal the big secret that these women share, or do you wait for people to kind of go along with it, like waves coming from the ocean. Do you anticipate that people will already have a feel for what's happening with these women?
You know, it's interesting. I think one of the things that's been so successful about the story is that, you know, it's set in Afghanistan, but quickly we see that it's not just the culture, that the culture doesn't become a barrier to understanding with the audience, mm-hmm. and that we see two women and that their friendship is first. And it's interesting because you know, when Laila and Mariam meet, there is, you know, an incredible amount of tension between them, and it's through the, you know, scene by scene in the moments that the relationship starts to evolve and change. I'm not sure if it becomes apparent of how that evolution manifests, and I think that's a part of the joy that the audience really is taken on a ride, so that each turn becomes necessary. Mm-hmm.
Nadine, I'm wondering, too, the extent to which war as a backdrop plays into these characters. How important is that, that this is a war-torn country and these women's lives have been impacted by what's going on in the macro, in the world outside?
I think it's incredibly relevant. And I think, as Denmark said, it's set in Afghanistan, but there are so many parallels to our politics today in the world and how women are treated in the world. And, you know, there is that quote, the measure of any society is how it treats its women. And I feel very strongly, I think particularly with Laila, because you meet her towards the end of the Soviet occupation, and you see her really grow up in real time. And I feel that Laila is a representation of what Afghanistan goes through. She represents the country. And I feel an incredible relationship with the audience and with the women in the audience because, you know, domestic violence is not exclusive to any culture or religion. It is everywhere. And women are fighting for rights all over the world. So it is important what these women are going through in this country, and it's important what women are going through all over the world. And so this story is transcends all of that.
I've seen scenes, stills from the production, and it seems to me that everything comes together to create a mood, the lighting, the staging, everything about it. And David Coulter, the composer, is actually on stage the entire time, right? And of all things, he's playing a musical saw. And if you're listening to it without seeing what that is, you have no idea what that is. I wanted to kind of give an example of what that sounds like. So this is the composer, David Coulter, and he's playing on stage of A Thousand Splendid Suns, and he's playing the musical saw. Let's listen. David Coulter was a little low, but you get the feel for how otherworldly and ephemeral it is. So I'm wondering the extent to which that music and lighting and everything else, all of those choices, those dramatic choices, set the tone for the play.
I mean, it's interesting. We've spent years now working on developing what the vocabulary of how to tell the story would be. And when David Coulter, who was there from the beginning, became a part of the project, it was clear that the music very much was the blood of the story. And it's an incredible tool to shift time immediately. So that with, the pull of the saw or the hit of this thunder sheet, we get a sense immediately of, the swell and the emotion of the story, which, a part of the play is told through emotion, not so much exposition. So we get a hit of the world immediately. And David Coulter, yeah, really becomes a fabric in which we can, you know, sort of fall into time, whether it's, you know, the play moves forward and back in time and travels over 30 years mm-hmm. within the span of the 2.5 hours. So, yeah, the music is, you know, it's really an atmosphere. It's a part of the set.
It's an incredible gift to have a live musician with us on stage mm-hmm. That we can react to, that he is reacting to us. It's a conversation that we're having that is so rare mm-hmm. to have. And it's a real gift to watch him. And sometimes we do. I mean, we're really connected with him, especially at the Geary, because he's right next to us. And so that's a wonderful thing to have.
Geary Theater is so intimate and really does lend itself so nicely to a production like this. So
yes.
It's extraordinary. We've been hearing today from Nadine Malouf, who plays Layla, and also from Denmo Ibrahim, who plays Miriam, in the ACT Geary Theater production of 1,000 Splendid Sons. It runs through July 29th, and it's just going to be, I can't wait to experience it. And I don't mean see it, I mean experience it. I feel like it's probably one of those things that you want to go and talk about afterward, you know, over coffee. You can't just go home after that. You've got to talk about it. So I'm just so grateful to both of you for being here, and I look forward to seeing your performances. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Renee Kemp, guest host this week for Open Air, KALW's radio magazine for the Bay Area Performing Arts. We're now going to take a look at the goings-on at Music at Menlo's 16th Festival. We're going to have a conversation with violinist Aaron Boyd. The 2018 edition of Music at Menlo is taking a look at musical and historical journeys through 7 major European capitals, including London, Paris, Leipzig, St. Petersburg, Berlin, Budapest, and Vienna. The Music at Menlo performances run through August 4th, and the festival not only presents concerts, but master classes and multimedia symposia in 3 different venues in Atherton, and Menlo Park as well. And I'm so grateful to have Aaron Boyd here today, the violinist who is playing an instrument that in and of itself is a character. I'm really looking forward to hearing more about the performance. But first, violinist Aaron Boyd enjoys a very versatile career as a soloist and a chamber musician, and also as a lecturer and teacher and a recording artist. He appears regularly as an artist in the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, and he has participated in the Marlboro Music at Menlo, La Jolla, Bridgehampton, and Prussia Cove festivals. Previously on the violin faculties of Columbia University and the University of Arizona, Aaron now serves as director of chamber music and professor of practice in violin at the Meadow School of the Arts at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. Welcome, Aaron Boyd.
Thank you, Renee. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's remarkable. Can we talk about the festival first?
Sure. We can talk about anything you like.
How long have you been involved with music at Menlo?
I have been there now for the past four summers with one interruption. So out of 5 years, I've been there for four of them. And each one has a remarkable environment, and it's a sort of remarkable experience because the artistic directors, David Finkel and Wuhan, give each summer a theme, which is a kind of structure to the repertoire which gets chosen, and even the topics which get discussed in the cafe conversations. And so each summer becomes a kind of ecosystem an exploration of all the things surrounding this basic theme, the structure of the summer. This one, with all the creative capitals, carries us all over the world and through a pretty sizable amount of history as well.
And what's your relationship with not only this particular music performance venue, but with the capitals that are featured in the music?
I've been to most of them. I haven't been to Budapest yet. But, the music that we're playing, I'm going to be playing some Russian music and some German music and the Schumann and the Balakirev. And having been to St. Petersburg and Moscow, and also obviously to Germany and to Paris, yes, I think that the most successful music written in those centers is one of the reasons why it's so successful is because it's so exportable outside of the local environment. And in fact, one of the fascinating things about lesser known composers are that they very often can, in a way, condense a national flavor more so than the more exportable composers. So you might have a composer like Balakirev that you don't know so well. Very often, precisely because their music is less exportable, you get a deeper sense of the local flavor of where they were living and writing at that time. So the music that we're going to be playing this summer goes from really, greatest hits type, Schumann, Brahms, Beethoven, that sort of thing, down to names you've never heard. And in each way, it is deeply revealing of their time and place and also their influence.
To what extent do you feel, Aaron, that this is an entree for people who are not already steeped in the music? Just how approachable is it? Is this sort of an on-ramp, or is this for people who are fully steeped in the music and who will recognize this when they hear it, or just how much of it is approachable?
Absolutely both. I mean, the programs and the music, both alone and together, they should appeal to every level of expertise. A total beginner, someone who's never been to a concert before, should come in there and have their, totally have their socks knocked off. And then at the same time, someone who is totally initiated ought to be refreshed by the presentation, by the circumstance, and by the company and everything. And so it's a refreshing experience for those who think they've been around and heard it all. And it should be very exciting for those who haven't.
I'm thinking, too, because you're working at two different concert programs, St. Petersburg on July 21st, and then Leipzig on July 25th and 26th. Which concert or concert piece do you look forward to the most?
Well, they both give me separate and unique experiences. The Balakirev, which I'm playing, is a piece I didn't know until—I'd never played until yesterday—
Really?
It's not often played. And it's a remarkable work. It's an early work of a composer, you know, since I mentioned earlier people whose names you might not know. It's a remarkable early work of this Russian, brilliant Russian talent. Very evocative, and you can taste the influences. You hear Chopin, you hear Weber, and you hear still this Russian quality to the music. And then the Schumann, which I'm playing next week, is just one of those supreme masterworks, which every time you confront it, can end up being an incredible and unforgettable experience. It's a really profound work.
Do you find one more challenging than the other, something a bit more obscure as opposed to something with which people are familiar and have certain expectations?
You know, it's funny you mention that. In my own career, I have found that it's the works which are most well known which I find most difficult to perform for a couple of reasons. First of all, I sometimes joke, I used to complain casually to my colleagues that there are some works that make me feel like a jukebox where, and, you know, I would even say that the Schumann's one of them where people put their quarter in and they expect to hear what they expect to hear. Mm. They want to hear their Schumann quintet. And the challenge there is for a musician to come up with a compelling enough idea that you can convince the audience that something new is worthwhile, that a new perspective on this piece is worthwhile, but it has to be really good. You have to be very convincing in it. And with something like the Ballet Kirov, which is, you can have a false sense of security in that they don't know how it goes, and you can be a little freer in that, but then there's sometimes a greater responsibility to sell a piece that's not known. You've got to sell it. And some people have the, I think, the slightly dismissive attitude that sometimes there's a reason why a piece isn't well known, that it ought to stay that way. That is not the case with the Ballet Kirov. It's just not known. And one of the great things about the repertoire is that you can dig. It seems to be now. I mean, I'll be turning 40 in September, and I've spent by far the bulk of my life doing this, that I'm still learning new works. I'm still finding you can keep digging for a lifetime and never run out.
Let's take a quick listen to the Schumann Quintet, if we have that ready to go. It's one of those, as you said, that people have their expectations. And so after we hear the clip, maybe we can talk about whether you feel confined, like you said, to a jukebox, or the extent to which you're going to kind of have some fun with your performance. Let's listen. That's a sampling. What goes through your head when you're listening to a recording like that, and what you bring to it when you play?
Well, I become mindful, especially just now, I become very mindful of the agony and ecstasy of Schumann's own life. I mean, he was young when he wrote this. I mean, he was 30-something, 32. And we know all too well the descent that was waiting for him. He descended into a really terrible mental illness, which caused him to die rather young. And so even in this work, which the clip of what you just heard was very optimistic and really ecstatic in a way, I'm always mindful of what was coming for Schumann, and it always seems to be lurking behind the, just below the surface, this instability, and again, this sort of ecstatic quality, which would later become a kind of impossible mental handicap for him. Very, very sad memory of Brahms, who was loved by the Schumanns and loved the Schumanns. The young Brahms went to visit Schumann at the mental hospital where he would spend the very last months of his life, and he became so sad at seeing Schumann there that he couldn't bring himself to say hello to him. He hid behind a bush and took comfort in watching Schumann carry on his activities. But it was a very, very sad thing. And yet you have to enjoy that quintet for what it is, which is just this a monumental and ecstatic experience.
Such a responsibility that you bring to every performance, not just the expectations that people bring with them, but also understanding the history of how this music came to be. And it's really remarkable. What do you hope that people take away from your performance, your particular performance?
I think that what I would like is for there to be a way to synthesize the responsibility. You're quite right to say the responsibility of presenting a monumental and important work like that. And yet, at the same time, we're still artists, and we are there to recreate, not just to recreate, but to create something. And the music doesn't sing unless we're playing it. And so I would like them to experience that, you know, a sense that something's being made in front of them and that we're all living it together at that moment. And it's an unrepeatable moment. It can only happen then and there and will never happen again. And that would be the ultimate takeaway for me, that something unrepeatable is taking place.
Unduplicatable.
Yes,
is that a word?
That's right, sure. Well, because it ultimately is. It's unrepeatable.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to violinist Aaron Boyd. He's a featured violinist at Music at Menlo. It's a 3-week festival through August 4th, and it features concerts and lectures and roundtable discussions and a chamber music institute for students ages 9 to 29, which is
extraordinary.
Also just extraordinary.
Yes.
Does that exist anywhere else? It must be one of only just a few in the world.
Oh, right? There's nothing in the world like Music at Menlo. I mean, it seems as if, you know, I always talk about the genius of the leadership of David Finkel and Wuhan. They took the best aspects of all the best music festivals in the world, the Marlborough Music Festival, Meadowmount, Tanglewood, and they brought it together and synthesized it in an incredible way. I don't know. I was coaching some students yesterday, all of whom are brilliant. They sound wonderful. They're incredible young people. And I think, my God, I'm glad that's not me, because they have everything thrown at them in the number of weeks that they're here. So it is extremely challenging. And I think in some ways it's probably overwhelming in all good ways. They probably go home shattered and then spend the next 11 months putting together those pieces both stronger and better. In a better way. I can't think of another place in the world which is quite as challenging and potentially life-changing as what the young people, and by the way, the artists like myself, also experience at Menlo. There's no other place like it where we work quite so hard and experience such intensity of learning and experience.
When you see your fellow violinists in that setting, the novitiates, so to speak, what do you think about what they're going through in their development?
I sweat for them. Just yesterday I was listening to this brilliant young trio playing a dress rehearsal, and my heart was pounding for them because I'm very sympathetic to their situation. I've lived that life. I still live that life. And I'm very sympathetic to it. And I realized at a young trio yesterday, there was a dress rehearsal. And who was at their dress rehearsal? I was there. Another colleague of mine, Arno Sussman, brilliant violinist, was there. Gil Kalish, a legendary pianist, was there. Wuhan was there. And here they just want to have their dress rehearsal. And there we are breathing down their necks. And, well, it's very uncomfortable for them, but that's very good. That kind of discomfort is that which they will absolutely grow from, and it's irreplaceable.
Your SMU bio says that you are, quote, vitally interested in the violin.
I am.
Tell me what that means and the history, and you're in demand as a lecturer about the golden age of violinists and their violins.
Yes.
So talk about the fact that you bring these young people along and initiate them into this world of the violin. What does that mean to you?
That's, if there's anything that I'm proud of and that I think maybe that I have to offer, which is unique, is my love of the violin history and of the instrument itself. I simply love the violin itself. And so I've gathered over the past number of decades, because I've been very lucky to have teachers who knew and who heard and who played with Golden Age violinists, I've gathered the history and their stories and recollections. And I feel that when I'm able to talk, again, David Figel and Wuhan give me the keys. They allow me to talk with the young people. I can give them a sense of the violin culture, almost as if, an access to a history that they wouldn't otherwise find. And it's so important. Just this morning, I was talking with students. I played a video recording of a great old violinist. And I said, you don't hear that now. You don't see that now. And unless you know it exists, you won't put it into your own sound. And so the great recordings, and which I'd like to lead them to, it's like these are keys to a secret garden, which they can use for the rest of their life by analyzing and by adding and by, yes, even copying, because there's no harm in copying as long as you maintain your own sense of self. These are things that you can add on to your own art and will augment your experience and what you offer other people.
And we, of course, have to talk about your special instrument. When I read the history of this violin, it's like, really? Talk about your violin.
Well, I have two. It's like the rest of everything I do in life. I straddle two worlds, one new and one very old. The violin I brought with me this summer was made, in the last decade by a very great, probably one of the greatest living violin makers, Samuel Zygmuntowicz. David Finkel plays a cello by him. It's a fantastic violin. But the violin that stole my heart is a gorgeous Venetian masterwork that was made in 1700 and by a gentleman named Matteo Goffriller, who was the violin maker to the stars. He was the violin maker for Vivaldi. So there's every reason to believe that this violin was the result of a commission by Vivaldi and was there with the young ladies at the Ospedale where Vivaldi worked, busy premiering his concerti. And right now that violin's being restored, and I haven't seen it for over a year. Mm. And when I see it again, I'll give him a big hug, and I'll have a beautiful reunion and make music, and knowing that this restoration will send this violin happily off for another 300 or 400 years of life and good concert service.
How did you come across this 400-year-old instrument?
I literally walked into a shop one day, and I said to the salesperson, who was a friend of mine, I said, show me something Venetian.
What city?
In New York City.
Mm.
And she said, you want to see something Venetian? I'll show you something Venetian. And she pulled this violin out of the safe. And I played on it. Interestingly enough, she was on the phone. She said, go play on it. And she was on the phone with a very fine violinist who knows my playing. And while she was on the phone, he asked her, he said, what violin is Aaron playing on right now? And she said, the Goffriller. And he said, oh, tell him to buy it. So I did.
So we won't get to hear from that one this
not
time.
Maybe next year.
Well, that alone is worth the trip.
Yes.
We've been talking to violinist Aaron Boyd. He's performing at Music at Menlo this year. It's a 3-week festival through August 4th, and there are concerts and lectures and roundtable discussions. And, of course, there's the Chamber Music Institute for students ranging in age from 9 to 29. Aaron Boyd, it has been just a real treat, just a pleasure. And I can't wait for this performance, but, of course, I can't wait for next year to hear from that venerable instrument. Thank you so much, Aaron Boyd, for being here.
Thank you for having me, Renee. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Open Air, KALW's radio magazine for the Bay Area Performing Arts, and I'm your guest host, Renee Kemp. We've heard today from Denmo Ibrahim and Nadine Malouf, the cast of A Thousand Splendid Suns, which runs through July 29th at ACT's Geary Theater. And we also just heard from Aaron Boyd, who's the premier violinist at Music at Menlo's 16th Festival. And now we are so grateful to have in our final segment a visit from absolutely the most venerable, Tara Faircloth. Thank you so much for being here, Tara.
Thank you.
We are talking about the Merylo Opera Program, and she's directing the Mozart opera Il Re Pastore as part of Merylo's 2018 Summer Festival that's running through August the 18th. This is, it's really set in classical times, and the title, The Shepherd King, gives you an idea of the sort of the sweep of this performance. It's a struggle between love and power, and it's about a shepherd out to be the rightful heir to a throne, and it transcends class and title, and it's really a remarkable performance, and we're so grateful to have Tara Faircloth here to talk about it. So, Tara, thank you for being here.
Yes, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's such a pleasure, like I was saying, you know, to talk about the Bay Area art scene. And Merylo is just such a contribution to that. Can you just talk about Merylo in general?
Sure. Merylo is one of the premier opera training programs in America. Young professionals all over the world, really, audition. And they choose, I believe, 20 singers, 4 pianists, and 1 director every summer. It's an entire summer festival. And we work together to produce 2 operas, a large-scale concert, and then the grand finale at the end, where we hear all of the singers and see all of them at work, see what they've learned for the summer.
And of those who are selected, how many people actually audition or attempt to join the cast? Are we talking hundreds?
Probably around 800.
Really?
Yeah. As I said, it's a venerable program. It's very prestigious. And it also is the launch of many young careers. So I have to say they have an amazing track record of picking singers who are in it for the long haul.
And you yourself are an alumnus, yes?
I am, yes. I came in 2006, and I really kind of mark that as the beginning of my professional career, so I owe a lot to Merylo.
What's it back circling like in this role?
I mean, it's kind of a lovely walk down memory lane, honestly. It's funny because so many of the administration are the same faces.
Oh.
But, of course, the singers are brand new, and it's just fun to imagine. We thought we were such big shots when we came in 2006, and now I'm seeing these young singers, and they are big shots, but they're young as well, and so it's fun to just imagine where they're going to be when they're, you know, 16 years later like I am.
How young are they?
I think they range between 25 and 32, maybe. Often Merylo is older singers. They're more at the end of their studies and ready to make their professional launch. And so they are slightly older than some other young artist programs in America.
Well, they are big shots.
They are big shots.
These are really, really like prodigies almost. Is that overstating it?
Well, no. I think if you're going to make it in the opera business, yeah, prodigy is part of the mix. And also a lot of hard work and a lot of dedication for a long time. So, yes, it's very exciting to see these singers really, you know, at the beginning of their professional launch.
Well, the program is widely regarded as the foremost opera training program for aspiring singers, as well as coach accompanists and stage directors. So
yeah,
it's really a wide spectrum of training. And to what extent is it a boot camp? I mean, is it really, just how rigorous is it?
It's pretty rigorous. They're taking lessons and classes, and they're in rehearsals for their various shows all day long. I think from, you know, like 10 a.m. to often 10 or 11 p.m., especially when we're in the technical portion of the rehearsal process. So it's also, they're very aware that the eyes of American opera are on them. And so I think they're also really grateful for the opportunity, but they know that a lot is expected of them. Mm-hmm. And there are auditions throughout the summer, and bigwigs from the opera community come, and, you know, to whom much is given, much is expected. So there's a lot of pressure for them, honestly.
Well, speaking of pressure, I know that it's a nurturing environment, but do people at some point just say it's just really too much, or are people so glad to have made the cut that they just power through it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, part of their education is learning to deal with stress and pressure in this way. And I don't know that anyone has ever cracked up during the summer, but but honestly, this is a time when they kind of need to figure out if they're going to sink or swim, because the rigors of being a professional opera singer or coach accompanist or director are great. They're emotional, financial, spiritual demands that kind of go beyond the call of duty as compared to other lines of work, I think.
Well, you are directing two world premieres with the Houston Grand Opera East and West Series, and you've had a tremendous career in regional houses such as Wolf Trap Opera, Utah Opera, Arizona Opera, Tulsa Opera, and mm-hmm. Atlanta Opera. How does this... I don't know about compare, but yeah. How is this different?
Well, I mean, the primary difference is this is a training program rather than my regional work is with professional companies. So they are companies which have systems in place, and, you know, we bring in professional singers who this is what they do for a living all of the time. This is much more comparable to, for instance, Wolf Trap Opera, which is in the D.C. area. And, you know, it's really exciting because of their youth and their excitement and their capacity to learn. I was actually talking with one of our administrators about how much difference there is in day one at Marilla and day 35, and then compare that to day 55, and just the growth that they experience is exponential from day to day. So that is super exciting. And you don't see that in professional houses. I mean, day one is usually pretty good, and then it gets a little better. I mean, of course, I hope it gets better as we rehearse. But in a young artist training program of this caliber, they just make amazing strides every single day.
I can imagine that's really rewarding, too, huh?
Yeah, I definitely think so, especially when you see the final product.
And how many female directors are there out there? Are you one of many or one of few?
Well, honestly, there aren't that many opera directors in the world to begin with. Mm-hmm. And it used to be a much smaller club. But I would say in the last, you know, since I've been a professional, there are quite a few of us. This year, both of the primary directors for Marilla are ladies, such as myself and Robin Guarino, and quite a few of the director apprentices who came through Marilla were female. So we're strong and proud.
I can imagine that you are, there's probably a lot of false modesty in there. Something tells me you really had to really show your stuff, right? You had to really excel, yes?
Sure. I mean, again, I think that's certainly relates to being a female, but also just the opera business is hard. There isn't room for people who aren't willing to really work. They might have a couple of opportunities, but the business is rigorous and demands the best out of you, so...
We're talking to Tara Faircloth. She's currently directing at the Marilla Opera Program. And Il Re Pastore is the performance. What is this opera about?
This is a wacky little opera by, speaking of youth, a 19-year-old Mozart. It involves two sets of lovers and Alexander the Great. there's a shepherd who is actually the unknown heir to the throne of Sidon, which Alexander has just taken over. And what can I say? It's a wacky evening. There's a lot of mix-ups. The lovers think they're going to be separated for life. It's a struggle of love versus duty. And bada-bing, bada-boom, happy ending.
Well, you know, those are some very common themes. Star-crossed lovers, mixed signals,
yes.
Duty versus a change of circumstance. Those are very common themes. But is there a message in it at all?
I mean, the ultimate message is that love conquers all. And, yes, this is definitely a theme that many opera composers grappled with. And Mozart in particular seemed very interested in the idea of what are the duties of a king versus how does the king approach his duties to the leadership role and his duties as a man to the person that he loves. He explored that in several operas, and this was his first attempt at it. And I think it's quite a charming one.
He was just a kid, right? How did that impact the work, do you think? The fact that he was literally just a kid.
Well, yes, it is interesting. This is not an opera that is done very often. And honestly, when you first start studying it, it's apparent that there are things he's definitely working out.
Like what?
Well, the story is not as quite as directed as it might be. As later operas that he produced. Also, the music is often, there are quite lengthy sections that really harken back to an earlier time period than the time period of that we typically think of Mozart's music landing in. And so, you know, I think it's actually a little jewel of a piece, and you can really, if you know Mozart's later work, it's fun to see where he began and how he really honed his skills. But that said, there are amazing moments in this piece that you don't hear anywhere else. So it's special that we're doing it, and I'm glad that the Bay Area has a chance to hear it.
Do you know where he was working at the time? What was going on in his life that he would tackle these particular themes?
I honestly don't know much about that off the top of my head, but I do know that he had recently seen another opera based on a similar story, and so he thought he would try his hand at it. The libretto was written by Metastasio, who was he had written libretti for all of the important opera composers of the previous era. I mean, Handel wrote many Metastasian libretti, and so Mozart was really... I mean, I think it's charming that the 19-year-old Mozart thought, yeah, I'm going to do that as well.
Sure. Are there challenges as a director of this particular opera?
Absolutely. One of the largest challenges is that the pieces are, they're quite long. And so, and in a Baroque fashion, they do not offer a lot of new material in each aria. So actually finding ways to stage that still provides interest for the audience continually is a challenge that I think I'm particularly suited for, and it's been super fun working it out with these kids.
Let's hear a very short clip from Il Re Pastore. That's a passage from Il Re Pastore, from Mozart. And what is the challenge? You're working with a very small cast, and a very young cast. What is the challenge with that?
Well, I don't think it's a challenge at all. I love having a small cast, and they definitely, you know, it gives us an opportunity to focus in on their characters and shine them and polish them and detail them in a way that you can't do with a large cast. And so that's very exciting for me.
Well, it's been exciting to hear sort of the backstory of how Merula works, and you're coming through the ranks and circling back as a director. Mm-hmm. It's really a fascinating story, and I look forward to seeing the performance. We've been talking to Tara Faircloth. She is the director at Merula's performance this year of Mozart's Il Re Pastore. Thank you so much for being here. And that's going to do it for Open Air this week. I'm your guest host. Thank you so much for joining us.